welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're busy making foil cups in association with OnFootballSearch.com. Well, it's been a good week on Planet Albion. A win at Leeds last Saturday has made everything taste just that little bit sweeter. But there's still a lot of work to do if we're to build on that win. It was our first win in 10, and the fixtures continue to come thick and fast. And Wednesday night's visit of Fulham could have a major impact on our season. First, though, we have to negotiate a tricky FA Cup tie with Blackpool, who dumped another Albion out of the Cup last round in the shape of West Brom. In other news, Tarek Lamptey has signed a new contract which will keep him at the club until 2015. And we've also seen the arrival of Michael Karbonic after he was recalled from his loan at Legia Warsaw. This has allowed Bernardo to head out on loan to Red Bull Salzburg for the rest of the season. And we also say catch you later to Matty Ryan, who has joined Arsenal on loan to the end of the season. Joining me today to discuss all this and more is, of course, Alan Wares. And we are delighted to welcome back two of Sussex's finest writers in the shape of Brian Owen and Nick Trepanic. Hello, guys. Welcome back to the show. So
well done. You finally got there. Take three. Well done.
Can we get something out of the way? It's Michal Karbovnik and Jakub Moder, just to get those pronunciation things. And he played for Legia Warsaw, not Legia Warsaw, whatever anyone says.
And Tarek Lamptey's signed up till 2025, not 2015. Apart from that, that was a beautiful intro.
I know, I did so well.
Yeah, on take three as well. How are you, AD? Yeah.
I'm all right.
Got your own teeth in tonight?
I have got my own teeth in tonight. But actually, before we actually get started, I do just want to say something quickly. Thank you to everyone who commented on our show last week. It was emotional, to say the least, it's helped just one person get over what the situation that we're in at the moment. And, you know, Ian Hart was very, very candid, Al. And, the show has gone a long way to help a lot of people, and people are actually talking now.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there has been a lot of comment on it. I mean, I want to bring Nick in on this because, you know, he's commented in, sort of in between broadcasts about this, that, you know, that... Like I say, as you put it, AD, the old black dog can follow you around, or you can be in the dark lands, and there is no shame in admitting this, Nick.
No, absolutely not. I mean, and credit to Hearty. I mean, there's a man who, you know, for whom up front is almost a sort of career definition, and his persona, as shown on the radio and as a fanzine editor and everything, is very much, you know, the sort of the cheeky chappy who can't who always seems, you know, to be bright and lively and never short of an opinion. And I think for a guy like him to come out and you know, reveal all those things, it would take a lot of courage for anyone, I think. But for something that's kind of counter to the picture we all have of Hearty. And you know, without doubt, I mean, he's a significant character in the recent history of the Albion for his work with Gullseye, but also, you know, the war years. And for that reason, you know, he perhaps he has a profile, and credit to him for using it in the way he has. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, when he talks, even if sometimes I think we all agree, you know, that to disagree with him on certain matters. But he's a man that we listen to. And I think well done to him for using the platform that he has in such a constructive way.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's get started then. And I think the obvious place to start would be the news that we just got. We're calling this Friday, and we've just got the news that Matt Ryan has gone to Arsenal on loan until the end of the season. Brian, did you see that one coming?
I think there was some talk about it on one of the local reporters mentioned it on Twitter, not so local, but South Coast, of Alex Crook, actually, on Talk Sport. So there was some hint of it happening. It's funny how things... I mean, it makes sense that he goes, obviously, because he clearly wasn't within the plans for Graham Potter. And it's funny how these things work out, going up to the backup at Arsenal when Brighton were interested in their backup to replace Matty Ryan at Brighton. And you think he must have who knows, we might even see him in a FA Cup final at the end of the season. But a great move for him.
Nick, I mean, the fall of Matty Ryan at the Albion has been pretty dramatic, though, hasn't it?
Well, it's different, isn't it, for goalkeepers? Because, you know, it's not that you're eased out for a couple of games and nobody notices, and you come back in. You know, the goalkeeper, it's very much a binary position, isn't it? You know, there's only one goalkeeper, and you know, you can't sort of be given, you know, 15 minutes rest at the end. That everyone notices. I just think that the strange thing is he's a guy who wants to play, and to go to a club where he's another backup. Okay, I suppose it's different. I mean, Arsenal is allegedly the club he'd always supported, so that's an opportunity that might not come another time. But you'd have thought that he'd have wanted to go to another club or another league, even where he'd have been a starter. Whether it's a sudden fall, I think there'd been a gradual erosion in his shot stopping, hadn't there? I mean, if you think that stats have anything to do with any part of football, then I think goalkeeping is one area where you can sort of identify things, you know, which are sort of discrete actions, and the number of shots that were finding their way past him. And I think Southampton's first goal was a moment. There was such a lot of discussion as to whether a taller goalkeeper might have reached it, or whether, you know, it tended to sort of throw the fact that he seldom comes off his line in certain situations into relief. I think it also coupled with Sanchez having some pretty impressive performances for the under-23s, and I think those things came together, and I think the moment was it was a surprise that it happened in the Tottenham away game and that Ryan was then back in. But I'm not certain I disagree with the change at all.
I think what you've got with Matty Ryan is that he's the kind of goalkeeper who flourished behind Duncan Duffy. You know, this sort of immovable pillars, these twin towers of Hercules that, you know, that when it came to bossing the area, those two would do that. Now, don't get me wrong, Dan Byrne is a big old fella, but he's not one who to boss the area. Shane Duffy was kind of a bully in the area. And you could then sort of see that Matty Ryan could be, well, not the sort of like the person, for all his shortcomings, and it's not the fact he's a short fella, because he's not, but like I say, as Nick said about not coming off his line that much, in the way that you can see that clearly Robert Sanchez does. But I think that Matty Ryan is the kind of goalkeeper that does very well behind two big fellas. And now that we've got White and Webster and Dunk, who are not, you know, they're not shrinking violets, but they're not these colossuses. I think that, you know, that you need that extra sort of presence in the area that Duffy did have, and now obviously not being there doesn't have.
I mean, that was always my issue with Matty. I mean, I know you think I've been overly harsh.
You thought he was 5 foot seven.
Well, no, I didn't. But I mean, it was, I had issues with, I do like a goalkeeper to come and dominate the area. And I'm delighted that Rob Sanchez is actually coming out and claiming crosses where Matty was largely staying on the line. It has helped the defence massively, I think, Brian.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, obviously, when it happened the second time he's left out, I suppose the writing was on the wall. But Sanchez does have that. He's hugely confident, isn't he? I can remember even seeing him in sort of the 23s, and he's got that aura about him. And he has made a few mistakes down the years as in his younger days, not so much in the first team at Brighton, but he's just got a presence about him. And I think talking to the scout who spotted him playing in Valencia as a Levante youth product, he said he went to watch somebody else, but Sanchez just stood out for that sort of presence that he had even as a young kid. He said he was like a kid in a man's body. So so far so good.
He looks so unworried by everything. He almost looks bored sometimes, doesn't he? He just has this fairly impassive expression and sort of stands there, grabs the ball. I do remember seeing an under-23 game when he just wandered out and caught across one-handed, and I thought, this is the guy for me. Spanish Pat Jennings, we'll have that.
Yeah, I think he comes across as a kind of a Marvel comic baddie, doesn't he? I mean, I don't think he's going to take any nonsense from anyone. And the incredible thing is he's only 23. I mean, for me, I think most goalkeepers seem to hit their rich vein of form at about 30. So, you know, even then, it's kind of interesting. He's overtaken Christian Walton very, very quickly, which I think was possibly down to the fact that Walton did hurt himself in that Chelsea game, which was a shame because that bloke has been, you know, sort of batting around the, you know, on loan for a long time.
And well, you just hit you just hit the nail on the head there, Al. I mean, that that game against Chelsea where Walton picked up the injury, I mean, that was, I mean, he was, it was going to be him and Ryan battling for the number one spot, wasn't it? And
but the leapfrog of Sanchez from number four to number one, that's the interesting thing. I mean, when it happened, I'll ask Nick or Brian, when it happened that it was Sanchez, the number four choice, leapfrogged all the rest of them. I mean, did you have an inkling at the time that that was going to happen?
Nick, do you, I didn't. I was at Tottenham and I didn't. But.
No, I didn't. Sorry, this will be just some junk call. I'll just let that ring out. No, I think it's difficult, isn't it? When you've got very promising young players, you know, that you have great faith in, which I understand that they've believed in Sanchez from quite a long way back, especially for goalkeeping. You know, you can't just sort of ease them onto the bench and maybe give them 5 minutes at the end, as I said, with a goalkeeper. So it's very hard to sort of ease them up the pecking order. Walton, the injury. Steele, there's been that sort of doubt about, isn't there? I'm still kind of bemused about Potter's praise of Steele as what a great job he's done as a number two. You know, if there's faint praise, that's got to be it, hasn't it? He's such a great backup goalkeeper. You know, he sits on the bench so brilliantly. And I mean, I know it's not that. I mean, obviously he helps in warm-ups and, you know, encourages other players and works with the strikers, you know, on their shooting. And it's a strange one that he didn't want to sort of disturb that part of the pecking order and put Sanchez. I don't think Sanchez, he kind of was number four if you thought Walton was ever back there really on a permanent basis. But I think he was a sort of de facto number three with Walton being injured again. And so it wasn't quite such
The mere fact that Walton didn't go out on loan, which he had done for each of the last five, 6 years, the fact he hadn't gone out on loan said to me that he was going to be there to challenge Ryan. So, and I think that's what you sort of took from that, wasn't it, AD?
No, definitely, yeah. And and he was back on the bench. I'm not sure if he was on the bench at Man City, but he was certainly on the bench at Leeds.
There's a hint that Walton's going to start tomorrow, isn't there?
It would make the sense if Jason Steele isn't available. There's nothing wrong with Sanchez playing. I mean, he still needs the experience. He's still only a half a dozen games into his professional career. But yeah. If the goalkeeper is going to be different for the Cups than it is for the league, then Christian Walton is the obvious sort of fella to start.
I think Walton's got to play. Just a couple more things on the keepers. Firstly, I was surprised Sanchez didn't play in the Carabao Cup, especially having asked a load of questions about him before the game against Portsmouth. And I just wonder about, and it's not the prime requirement of a goalkeeper, the ball on the grounds, the footwork, the ability to control the ball and play out as a keeper. And I think Walton... maybe still question marks over that, where there isn't ever Sanchez. And there was one, even in that friendly against Chelsea, with the 2,500 fans, there was one period where Walton got caught on the ball and it nearly caused a goal. And I think that has always been a question mark. And I know it's something he's tried really, worked really hard on. But I wonder if for the way Potter plays and what he looks for a keeper, that is one factor as well, where Sanchez has got an edge over Walton.
But, I mean, just to let some daylight in upon Magic a little bit. Brian, one of my main memories of Rob Sanchez was sitting next to you in the press room at the Amex after we got beat by, I think, Aston Villa in the League Cup. And we were sat there and we were like, where's Potter? Is he actually ever going to bother coming in?
I remember.
And we were watching it. It was like Rochdale were Man United in that night as well, and it went to penalties and Sanchez was in goal and Potter eventually comes in and goes, oh, if I knew it was all in here, I'll have come and watched it with you lot. And it was like, because he was obviously
Sanchez
his goalkeeper.
Was playing for Rochdale that night.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he did very well as well.
And they were a footballing team and he cost them a goal, didn't he, at Newcastle in the FA Cup, trying to play out from the back. But I still think, I just wonder if that's a factor because he's got that more than what Walton has, but we'll see.
I think a goalkeeper's only going to learn by those dropsies anyway.
Yeah. Make them for another team as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to happy times at Leeds last Saturday. A win always makes your weekend that much sweeter, doesn't it? And there was a few changes to the team, but my eyes were drawn mainly to the bench, actually, where we had five academy players on the bench for this game, which is massive. Probably the first time that's happened. We had Chris Walton, Stephen Elzatti, Alexander's, T. Teddy Jenks and Reda Khedira all on the bench.
Well, I don't think you can really call Christian Walton an academy player anymore. He is 25, so...
He's been
playing for the 23s just because he needs to get his minutes back. But he's not an academy. He is definitely a first team player these days. I mean, you don't go from 6 years in the championship to going back to the academy. So, but I take your point. Yeah, I mean, I still
class Lewis Dunk as an academy player. So,
and Tommy Elphick.
Yeah.
I thought the interesting thing about the bench was another person who was on it, which was Bissouma. I think we had all assumed that Yves Bissouma was going to come straight back into the team. And then we had Gross alongside Ben White. I've been critical of the Ben White in midfield experiment, but I thought for the first time I looked at him there and I thought, God, you know, maybe this is a thing. Maybe Ben White, you know, my man of the match. I know Dunk did brilliantly, but I think Ben White's contribution in that position, which is one he's only played intermittently, I think, before this season. And I think he's growing into it. I don't know whether that means that his career as a centre-half is over, but I think that he now actually is really looking the part in that holding midfield player and also driving forward as he did for the goal.
I mean, all I'd ever say about that is that what was the groundsman doing?
Oh, well, they'd meant to relay the pitch in the summer, but the COVID pandemic prevented that from happening, so it was due to be relayed. It's apparently the same pitch as was laid for Euro 96, so it hasn't got any of the those sort of plastic blades that most Premier League pitches have.
I would put in the caveat about the pitch though that they did have to clear a load of snow off it prior to that and the bad weather. But I mean, the length of the grass was just ridiculous, particularly for a team like Leeds who like to play the ball and like to play quick passes, as do we. They just didn't get a chance to mow it either. But it was, it was a dreadful surface.
Bad as Blackpool's a few years ago.
Not bad as Blackpool or Newport's the other day, actually.
No.
You're right. Pascal Gross came in. Solly March, we all got back into squads. Like you said, Yves Bissouma was on the bench as well. And there was an early warning as Rodrigo couldn't quite get in the end of Alioski cross. But that was pretty much the end of Leeds' threat in the whole game, Brian.
I just remember one that flashed across in the second half, wasn't it? I can't remember who it was. Flashed across goal, which looked dangerous from... I watched it on TV. I didn't go up there. From our camera angle, which probably wouldn't have looked dangerous from the other side of the pitch, perhaps. But I think that was probably obviously, Brighton played some great goals, some nice football, but also the untroubled way, if you like. They saw that out. I think that was probably as good as the goal. That wasn't the late scares as at Aston Villa with that penalty, or say at Norwich at the end of last season.
Mm. Well, what I couldn't have a feeling was the way that Leeds attacked, and they did attack with purpose, albeit sort of slightly bluntly, was there was an awful lot of stuff that was coming in as crosses. You know, we effectively retreated to not exactly allow it, but, you know, we gave them the freedom of the wings, because every time they crossed it, it was going to be hoofed out by one of our defenders. And I'm thinking, if you're ever going to play into the hands of our defence, that's the way you're going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, Bielsa's supposed to be, you know, such a great coach. But the thing about Leeds is they very much play their way, you know, and they have a system. And I think the Leeds fans are, oh, well, you know, it's Bielsa ball and no one will be able to deal with it. But he doesn't seem to adapt it very well. I mean, if you've got one not particularly robust forward up there in the shape of Bamford up against our three guys, then crosses are a waste of time. Yet they persisted with them. And I don't think they adapted to the surface. I mean, I think if looking at that pitch, you know, which was definitely inimical to their style, I think Bielsa could have done something different. I was waiting for him to make some tactical change, but it never came. Still, never interrupt an opponent when they're making a mistake, as they say.
Yeah, their problem. Okay. And yet, ironically enough, our goal was, you know, was something that didn't befit the pitch.
No, I was just going to say we've got to talk about that goal. And yeah. What superlative would you like to use to describe it, Brian Owen?
Superlative. I don't know. I mean, it was. I can't really think of one particular. Free flowing probably. Sums it up. Quite nice. Obviously, McAllister playing a huge part in it, and it was a really nice pass from earlier on. I don't quite understand with Mope how he didn't remain on his feet for whatever reason.
But no, this was the penalty shout, yeah. wasn't it? And yeah, you're absolutely right, because I mean I think he felt there was contact and he felt entitled, for want of a better phrase, to go down. But he would have been better off staying on his feet.
Yeah, I'm not throwing any accusations or whatever. I was just a bit surprised, a bit bewildered by it, if you like. But the goal, I mean, it was a nice little pass into the net from him, wasn't it? But it was one of those almost like Glenn Murray in a way, all the hard work from the striker's point of view goes on while we're not watching. And he was on the left wing to start off the move. And then, I mean, we saw what happened with the ball. McAllister, he's got that sort of go forwards, that looking to attack. And it's quite nice to see him now having a little a little run, but it's a start of hopefully a bit of productivity, because he gives something a bit different as well, sort of aggressive in sort of intent, if that's a right way of putting it.
There was a great contribution from Trossard as well, and something I kind of liked during the celebrations. I actually saw Trossard crack a smile. I don't think he smiles.
No, didn't happen. Didn't happen.
Not having it.
It was that was really weird. I was slightly unnerved by that. But I can't
look beyond the whole notion of Trossard has not slept for 3 days. That's how he always comes onto the pitch.
My mother-in-law thinks he looks ill.
Well, I liked what he did, and I liked the fact that he was then bursting through the left side of the Leeds defence with that cross, I think, not shot, that was deflected against the bar.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That,
I can't remember. I read somewhere, you know, that somebody said that Trossard was the guy who seems to have fallen off most since he arrived at the club, you know, and looked such a promising talent in his first home game against West Ham. And a lot of that seems to have disappeared from him. But I wonder whether we're seeing a bit of that sort of attacking, that desire to get forward and to make things happen, just coming back a bit in the last few weeks.
I think the issue for me with Trossard is his decision-making. You can see that the spirit is there. It's the notion of he's trying to do what Bissouma does, but he's only half Bissouma's size, where he'll try and shield the ball and spin his man. And Bissouma is actually adept at doing this quite well. And Trossard isn't, because, frankly, a puff of wind will take him over. And I think that it's actually Trossard's got to learn that actually it's usually best to play the simple ball. I mean, you will get a magic champagne ball now and again out of him, but I think that for the sake of consistency, I think for me, it's just, if you can just remember the mantra, keep it simple, I think he'd be far more effective then.
And it's you mentioned his decision making there, his shooting ability. I mean, he's hit the woodwork 6 times this season now, and he's only scored 1 goal this season, which is that's a telling stat, really.
Shoot slightly lower. That's where your decision making's faulty.
Yes. Yeah, there is that. He is a character that, you know, I mean, you know, I've been onto other fans' podcasts, and they do rate him. They see something about him. They see a bit of menace about him, and I can understand that. But when you're watching him, you know, sort of week in, week out, and you see that it's that, come on, keep it simple. Look, there's the Burns available, you know, Bissouma's available, play it. Don't try and beat, you know, the sixth man, because, you know, the seventh one will tackle you. It is ultimately the decision making, and once he can get that sorted, maybe it can be coached into him. I don't know, but if he can get it sorted, then we have one hell of a player there.
I knew friends from South Africa absolutely love Leandro Trossard, don't they?
Oh crikey! I don't actually. I said this on the show a lot recently, Nick and Brian. I don't know if you've noticed this, but it was the game. I think I might have been in the Man City game where. It was Trossard got dog's abuse from the South African fans. Because
not passing to Percy Tau.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder with Trossard, I mean, obviously there's the Euros at the end of the season, possibly. And he desperately wants to make sure he's got his place in the Belgium squad. And is he just trying too hard? Is he just thinking, oh, you know, I must impress by beating 7 men, not 6, before rifling it into the roof of the net. You know, that I think Martinez will be just as impressed by, you know, a well-timed pass as by, you know, just one more man in the dribble.
Maybe that's because Trossard's now got a really creative player alongside him in Alexis McAllister, who for the last couple of games has been absolutely outstanding, and his vision and his range of passing has been wonderful, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, he's had various issues, I think illness, injury. Maybe this is the real Alexis McAllister, and this is what he looks like, you know, with confidence and feeling physically, you know, up to speed, and And you'd like to see him have a run in the side, of course, which is the thing. Of course, with Graham Potter team selection, that's not necessarily a given, is it? Obviously, tomorrow's a different thing. But, you know, I think we'd love to see him playing again against Fulham on Wednesday.
Brian, any word from sort of Latin America, from down in Argentina, as to how they feel their man's getting on?
There hasn't been an awful lot. In fact, it's mainly been about Bielsa. Firstly, pictures of from the Broadfield Stadium in Crawley, and then from last Saturday. It was a great picture of the McAllister family, who are like footballing, you know, a really well-known family. You've got the dad who played for Boca in Argentina and the two brothers. Just before the Leeds game, they put on their social medias there in front of the TV with the screen behind, saying, you know, cheering on their boy sort of thing. So I am in contact with one of his brothers, who's obviously quite a well-known footballer over there. And he just says that this was after the Palace game, that Alexis just looks a different shape, a different sort of physique. He looks a different like man and a different player, because I think the physical demands are greater here, even though Argentina can obviously be a bit physical and a bit rough and tumble. He says he had that
in a slightly different way.
He has that throughout his game. You know, that the training has been different, and he just looks different. He looks fitter, looks stronger, probably less creative. If I could just mention as well, having watched that game, he didn't get many headlines, but I really like Joel Veltman as an old pro, as a player who protects a lead and, you know, gets a free kick and takes forever to get up and then keeps the ball. And I thought he was somebody who really caught my eye in the latter stages at Elland Road, who probably didn't get the headlines of.
He's becoming a player that I thought he would do, because at the beginning of the season, and Andy pulled me up on it, fair enough. he pointed out to me, he said, you know, who do you have, Tarik Lamptey or Joel Veltman? And I felt Joel Veltman just for the experience, but I think it's not... I mean, obviously everyone wants to see Lamptey, but in a situation like that, where you're hanging on for a 1-0 lead, or you need a professional head about you, I think that's where Veltman's experience does come in.
I think at Villa he did that. He did bits and pieces like that as well. Yeah. My memory's not failing me. But there was that great bit towards the end where Davy Proper got the ball and was weaving his way to the corner flag. And then I think Veltman came in support. And just the two Dutch internationals, probably ideal if you want two players to play keep ball by the corner flag for a minute or two.
I'm absolutely loving seeing Davy Proper playing further forward. I think it's great. And he's looking like he's got his mojo back, and that could only be good. I mean, the amount of selection headaches that Potter's now got is just he's got to chop and change it anyway. But he's got a whole stable, let alone horses and courses. He's got a whole stable full of them. It's ridiculous.
Move factory at his disposal.
Yeah, and just before we move on, I just want to just quickly talk about Adam Webster. I mean, is he going to score the goal of the season, frankly? I mean,
He's going to try.
The way he's carrying the ball forward at the moment, I think if the pitch was a carpet like we're used to playing, like the Amex and various other stadiums around the country, rather than the bog that it was, I think that might have actually made it into the bottom corner.
Well, it's going to be him or Ben White, isn't it? I mean, I think they're going to try and outdo it. If Webster does it, then White's going to try and do it. And, you know, because you know he was gambling forward, you know, at pace and at leisure, and frankly trolling Leeds United, I thought that day. But yeah, he will do it one day. I suspect it will come in off someone's backside, but it will look great.
Okay.
Well, Webster has scored goals for us. I mean, he knows where the net is, and we've yet to see that from White. Although the goal White scored in the last game of last season for Leeds suggests he's got a shot on him when he has the chance.
I think if Webster was going to get goal of the month, December was the time. When was it? Danny Welbeck's chest down and three-yard volley won it. That was a little bit disappointing. But a few good contenders for January already, from what I've seen.
Yes.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We, of course, brought you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has provide us with another shirt of the week, which who wants to describe this one, Nick?
Blue and white, my first, well, mainly blue with sort of white bits underneath the sleeve, what looks like a sort of Reeboky type of pattern in there somewhere, and a crest somewhere in the middle. And I was thinking, oh, well, this is probably something to do with either Lech Poznan or Independiente de la Valle, and just to celebrate one of our new signings. But then, I don't know, while other people have a guess, I've actually decided to have a completely different and off-the-wall guess, which is either genius or absolutely and completely wrong, and nothing has ever been more wrong.
Go for it.
I think it's a Blackpool away shirt.
Okay, because I mean, it's the nationwide bit that goes across the chest, the sponsor thing, that makes me think it's not going to be. It is an English side.
It's not Independiente.
Well, no.
Yeah. No.
I was thinking Blackpool or Burnley or something like that, but I don't know why.
I'm stuck by this, because I mean, the first thing that sprang to mind was Gillingham. It's just the shade of blue and the standing lions and what have you. The what's it called? It's not Lions Passant, is it? It's
Ardent,
yes. Macclesfield.
Oh, Rampant.
Rampant, that's it, yeah.
No, it's not Macclesfield. It is Northern. So is
Burgess Hill, frankly.
Of course, it's true. But I'm not going to do it in a Northern accent. You'll be delighted to hear.
Please don't.
This is the 1998-99 home shirt of Halifax Town FC. Known as the Shaman, they were formed in 1911 and sadly went out of business in 2008. A Phoenix side was promptly formed, FC Halifax Town, who now occupy the original stadium, the 14,061 capacity Shea Stadium, and they play in the National League. The name Shaman comes from the word Shea, derived from the old English word shaw, which means a small wood thicket or grove, which was on the site when the stadium was eventually built on. The shirt was worn on their return to the Football League, having won the conference in 97-98. And Jeff Horsfield starred for them and had been the top scorer in the league until he was sold to Fulham in 88. A couple of years later, they were relegated back to the conference, and an ex-Albion player, Chris Wilder, took on the role as the manager in 2002, a role he held in 2008. Some other Albion links for you include Kieran O'Regan, who played for Halifax between 95 and 98, before going on to the manager's side before announcing his retirement as a player. Larry Robertson made 46 appearances for the Albion in 74-73, having joined us from Halifax. Legendary Seagulls striker Dave Cameron made fewer appearances for Halifax than he did for the Albion, but still managed to score more goals, a grand total of one. Mark Cartwright, Willie Irvine, Jason Peake, Jake Wright and Frank Worthington also pulled on the shirts of both Halifax and Brighton. So thank you for that, Phil.
Can I also point out, AD, I think it was, I think I've got the right side. It's the team of which Bobby Samora scored his favourite ever goal.
Yeah. It was, and the ball was given, wasn't it?
It was Chris Wilder who belted it straight up in the air and Bobby Samora tucked it into the far corner with a volley.
Well, of course, you can see that and many others over on oldfootballshirts.com. And again, thank you to Phil for that.
And with the FA Cup game, we've got fourth round coming up against Blackpool. Now, Blackpool, as we were discussing on the show last week with Harty, they've been through their mill. They had their war years. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Tony Wilkinson, Deputy Chair of the Blackpool Supporters Trust. He's joined us on the Albion Raw to, well, look back at their war years and look ahead to the cup game. Tony, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw. Now, it's been a tumultuous, I mean, I don't know how many years you want to put into it. 10, 15. Give us the abridged version of what on earth happened at Bloomfield Road during the 2010s.
2010s, yeah. 2010-11, we were in the Premier League, and from there on in, it went downhill. Obviously, vast amounts of money sloshing around, and, should we say, unscrupulous owners. It was a, you know, recipe for disaster. And the money was, I mean, previously, people were not happy with the ownership of the club previous to the Premier League. But the point then was, we were little Blackpool. We had no money. So there was very little to siphon off anyway. But then when the riches of the Premier League came along, and in one particular year, £11 million was paid to Owen Oyston, disguised as some sort of, you know, company dividend, but in fact was £11 million paid to him. I think it still stands as the highest amount ever paid to a football club director.
as bonuses go, it's kind of eye-watering, isn't it? Given that, you know, our good friend Kieran Maguire, the football finance expert, will tell you that, you know, the Premier League is still losing money hand over fist. That's a nice thing to be able to give yourself a 11 million quid without actually batting an eyelid, isn't it?
It just continued from there that, you know, money was just dwindling. There was no real investment in the club. The club was, you know, dropping down the leagues. The fans had had enough. It wasn't the fact of we weren't in the Premier League. Blackpool fans did not expect to be in the Premier League whatsoever. It was quite a miracle that we'd got there. It was the fact of the existence of the club was starting to be undermined, realistically. We started to campaign. A supporters' trust was formed.
Was there a particular moment, a straw that broke the camel's back or a red letter day that said, right, we've got to get organised?
There was that most people see, that most supporters see, was when the Oystons started to sue the fans.
Wow.
And really, really take people's livelihoods away from them. There was, you know, people being absolutely hammered for any word that they would say against the Oystons. They would be taken to court. They would be asked to cough up £20,000, etc. It was an absolute ridiculous situation. And from this point, there was no going back.
It never ends well when the people associated with the board of directors sue the fans. I mean, in living history, I don't think it's ever ended with kissing and making up, has it?
No, not at all. Anyway, so we got through the boycott years, and we got to a point where the 20% shareholder, Mr. Bellicon, has also realised that he's being had, so to speak, and wasn't getting the share of what he should be receiving. It took until November 2017 in court that the judge decided that, you know, what we had been saying and what Mr. Bellicon had taken the Oystons to court for, the amount of money, should be paid from the Oystons to Bellicon. An eye-watering amount, £31.2 million, was awarded.
That's a happy weekend in the pub, isn't it?
It really was. It really was a happy weekend for Blackpool fans, because this, for us, was the end of the Oystons. So we thought. Yeah. But, as ever, they wriggled and wriggled. They wriggled. It was reputed that they'd paid £10 million of that off gradually. But still, the club was struggling. And it took until we got to February 2019, which was the real big turning point, when we got to the point that the only way that the Oystons were going to be removed was by calling in the receivers at the club. Now, this is a strange one. I don't think there's many fans that have campaigned and wanted receivers to be called in at their club.
But it's for the greater good, isn't it?
It was for the greater good, exactly, yeah. And what this would do would get Mr. Bellicone's money, but also it would remove the Oystons from ownership of the club, and the receivers were then tasked with the job of, you know, finding a new owner for the club. Mm-hmm. Now, this went really, really well, especially, I mean, just now, currently, when you look at the case with Wigan Athletic, they're in a desperate situation. The receivers there are not doing a good job. Mm. And we were fortunate that David Rubin and partners with the receivers at Black, with a guy called Paul Cooper. Now, Paul Cooper, I was in court in February 19 when the receivers were appointed. Mm-hmm. A few dozen Poole fans there as well. Emotional day. There was tears in court. There was, because we knew that that was the real end of the Oystons. We came out of court and stood there was a man, smart suit, nice gentleman, smiling all over his face. He introduced himself. It was Paul Cooper. And he really got it. He said, this is for you. This is for the supporters. You deserve this. I've been watching this case over the past years, and I understand what you've been through, and this day is for you. And I guarantee you that we will sort this mess out. And that was what he told us as we came out of court. And that was really heartening, as if we weren't happy enough. What progressed then was that the club was put up for sale. 4 months to the day, on the 13th of June, it was announced that Simon Sadler had taken over the club, mm-hmm. lock, stock, mm-hmm. and barrel, the whole lot. was in his hands. This was amazing. This was unbelievable.
I mean, was there not worries about frying pans and fires here, where you got one person in charge of things and you're thinking, hang on, you know, suppose this goes belly up as well? I mean, was there any thought of that at the time?
We had a good relationship with the receivers. The receivers were speaking to the fans, and the receivers were adamant that they would not let any shysters into the club. Mm-hmm. That was not going to happen after what we'd been through. And the due diligence done by them was amazing. Finding a buyer such as Simon Sadler was also amazing, mm-hmm. in the fact that Simon Sadler is a local lad, made good, a supporter, but also happens to be the owner of a hedge fund, Saganti Capital, in Hong Kong, a very, you know, successful businessman who decided that Blackpool needed saving, you know, and he wanted to be that person, that custodian, as we say. And that is his role, and he sees it that way.
Did you know him before he stepped up to the plate?
In various, you know, fan groups and circles and conversations, this name had vaguely been mentioned. It had, you know, people had rumoured it and mentioned it. But it was one of them too good to be true moments, really. Mm. I remember the receivers, they had a meeting with the fans, and they said to us, we are looking for your unicorn. We hope to find your unicorn for you. And in the end, they said, we found your unicorn. And sure enough, you know, it was unbelievable what had happened. What I would say about it was, because at that point when the receivers had come in and when Simon Sadler took over, the fans were helping as much as they could. There was a volunteer group set up, helping to, you know, get the stadium ready for the, what was called a homecoming game when we first went back. And that was, you know, amazing times. But it became apparent that things were far worse than anybody could have dreamed of. We knew the Oysters were running the place down, but it was unbelievable, the state of the place. Mm-hmm. And Simon Sadler, really, to me, I would term it, it's like you would say in the old days, you buy a car and it's sold a scene. He yeah. bought a football club, sold a scene off the receivers.
He realised it's a football club with only three wheels.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Probably two only in this case. Yeah. The amount of things that needed putting right, the amount of infrastructure, you know, and the state of the stadium and place where he still constantly is spending money, like you say, let alone the COVID situation. It is really fortunate that he is, you know, prepared to invest in the club. And that's where we are. We're dependent on the fact that he is able and willing to invest in the club. Recent figures, he's quoted that it may cost him anywhere between 4 and 6 million this season out of his own pocket to throw into the club to keep it where it needs to be. He's doing all and everything he can. I feel very sorry for the fact that, first of all, there was the situation as how bad the club was that he'd taken over. Mm-hmm. Sort of trying to get through that a little bit and move on a bit. And then we get COVID. So, you know, in his first months, years of taking over the club, he's not had a lot of luck. So I do think once we get onto a bit more of a level playing field, you know, things can really take off and happen. But it is so fortunate that Simon Sadler came along.
So in talking about what we did last week on our show, we were talking about sort of the parallels between the Brighton war years from 95 to 97, trying to get rid of Archer, then the 2 years trying to get back to Brighton, and then the 12 years in trying to get the stadium. There's like I said, there's incredible parallels with Blackpool. Thankfully, they didn't involve the receivers at the Albion, but the parallels are there are quite astonishing. Now, obviously, it's now nearly the 24th anniversary of Fans United, the original Fans United, the brainchild of a 16-year-old Plymouth fan called Richard Vaughan. But you, Tony, and your Blackpool fans, you've had support from across the country. So obviously, like I say, COVID is still sort of, you know, you're still on the get set position at the moment. But what would you say to all those fans across the country? And I include Preston fans in this, who raised their head above the parapet to help Blackpool's cause.
Personally, thank you very much, because it was much appreciated that, you know, I remember the day the Brighton fans were down. It was a pretty big protest that day. It got pretty feisty. I was stood outside the ground there and speaking with Brighton fans. And it meant a lot that we felt like, you know, as football fans, you feel like a voice on your own sort of thing. But then when you start to speak to other fans, you realise, no, you're not going mad. You're quite right in what you're saying. And it's happening to other clubs. But also what I would say to fans, particularly of, say, clubs where they've not encountered such problems, they need to bear in mind that, you know, they're just one bad owner away from this happening to them. Because there's very little still to stop it from happening. Hmm. But again, that is where Football Supporters Association have a very big campaign, Sustain the Game, and for a reform of, you know, governance within the game. And hopefully at some point that will move forward, because things need to change or else this could still happen.
Is there one small kind of, it sounds like a perverse question, but is there a small part of you that misses the camaraderie of the battle that you had?
You're probably right there, yes. Yeah. Strange as it may seem, because we were in quite a routine of every home game going down to the main entrance, putting our flag down on the floor, getting our leaflets out, handing them to away fans, having a chat for an hour and a half before a match, and then at 3 o'clock walking away. And that was what we did for years.
I ask this because I know what we went through. I mean, like the camaraderie of, you know, are we ever going to get our stadium? Are we ever going to get back to Brighton? Are we ever going to get back, you know, rid of Archer and so on? So I can see that with your expression there, you think,
yeah,
actually, yeah, it is perverse, but you know, you and I say this because I'm going to speak on your behalf now. I think that you're very proud of what you did, and from a Brighton fan's point of view, I think you should be.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that is the case. I mean, it was to be honest, the letter of the law on this. It was brought about by a court case brought by a minority shareholder. Mm. That was how legally this happened, but as you've praised there, the fans really did play a big part in it. They really did.
Now, let's look forward to this weekend. Brighton are playing Blackpool in the FA Cup, fourth round. Looking forward to it. Thankfully, I have a privilege, and it is immense privilege, of being able to be there with my press pass. I'll probably freeze, but, you know, it's going to be an immense privilege, and knowing full well that a 30,000 stadium is otherwise going to be empty. And that's something I'm really going to miss this weekend, probably more than many other games, is that, you know, in the story that you've just told, Tony, and I appreciate it's only a tiny, tiny fraction of the Blackpool story against the Oistons, but it would have been fantastic to have had a fans reunited. I don't know how you feel about this, to have had a fans reunited, and we'll all prop up the bar and tell each other our own war stories.
Exactly. Of course it would. Yeah, there's so much, as you say, in common here. And we both sets of fans fully understand, you know, how difficult times were and how much better times are now. Yeah.
So what can we look forward to for Saturday's game then from the Tangerines?
Well, hard to say for sure. I expect a good game, an exciting game. You know, it's the FA Cup. It's always a good game in the FA Cup, I feel. And we do try to play football. Neil Critchley, you know, wants to really play football with the team. We're a bit hampered with injuries. Am I getting my excuses in earlier? Maybe. But we are. We're hampered with injuries. We've got two couple of players have gone back to the parent clubs that were on loan, Kemp and Woodburn. So, you know, we're not at full strength. We have brought a loan in from Everton, Ellis Sims, a young lad who can knock goals in for fun, apparently. I hope to see him on the pitch. But also up front, Medine and Yates have been doing quite well. Yeah, they've started to form a bit of a partnership there. Gary Medine in particular, quite a handful for most defences. It could be a very, very exciting game, I think.
Very much looking forward to it. And also looking forward to the day when Blackpool can actually function as a fully fledged football club rather than to forever having to pick up the pieces of yesteryear and actually can look forward and be hopefully playing you sometime soon in the Premier League. Tony Wilkinson, Deputy Chair of the Blackpool Supporters Trust, thanks very much indeed for coming onto the Albion Raw.
And it's such a shame that we can't get together with the Blackpool fans after the game now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I say, the war stories would have been great. I mean, I mean, don't get me wrong. The club, you know, is trolling Blackpool a little bit. They've put up the 6-1 game from the 2013 season where we were really, really good. You know, a 7-match ban from Ashley Barnes didn't stop his return and scoring 2 goals. And it was probably one of my favourite ever Amex goals, certainly from the early days of Andrea Orlandi. Yeah.
Oh, the Orlandi David corner 1-2. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Love that. And the hilarity that you could see on the Blackpool fans' faces when Hammond fired in that bullet own goal.
Who doesn't love a diving header own goal? That was a tremendous effort.
It was Hawkins-esque.
It was Hammond-esque. You take your pick.
I've actually done a piece about the... Do you remember the 2-2 draw?
Kevin Phillips.
The start of the Amex era. And that shows how things changed because... The angle that I took was that almost felt like the first taste of sort of Premier League higher division life at the Amex because they'd just come down Blackpool and they had like Kevin Phillips obviously scoring the 2 goals. And it was Brighton had started at home against Doncaster and Gillingham. Mm-hmm. And then Blackpool, fresh from the Premier League, they'd done the double over Liverpool the previous season. And then we saw, you know, Brighton 2-0 up, 2-1. These are the games you always win. And then the cruel finale and the real sort of the harsh reality of the higher division when... Mm-hmm. You don't always have the fairy tales. So I think that's, you know, that felt like the first sort of biggish feeling.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, in those early days, the sun was always shining at the Amex as well.
Blackpool fans complained the Amex was too hot, which is seems to be a good
I've been there, and it certainly has been too hot for sure. Wasn't Dobby playing in that game as well?
I think so. I had a look at the lineups. They had Taylor Fletcher, if you remember him. They just signed Barry Ferguson.
God, yeah, yeah,
and. It just felt like, you know, those were days when Brighton playing Bolton or going to Ipswich or playing Blackpool were real challenges to test themselves against Premier League opposition. It's quite noticeable, you know, how things have changed.
I miss going to Bolton. It was great. They've got the world's happiest statue in the town centre. It's brilliant. It's
happiest statue.
I didn't mind going there when they opened the railway station about 20 yards from the Reebok. But before then, when the trains used to go passing them, you couldn't get on them more often and you had to get a cab back into Bolton. That was horrendous.
But no, they've got this statue of Fred Dibner in their town centre with brushes and with a great big beaming smile. I've never seen such a happy statue in my life. It's absolutely brilliant. Well, OK, well, let's move on to... obviously, the window is still open, Nick, and... I'll let you pronounce the new arrival because you're so much better than me, clearly.
Well, Jakub Modder and Mikhail Karbovnik.
Karbovnik, yeah. Yes, indeed. So what do you know about them?
Modder is obviously further along in his development. You know, he's been playing Europa League for Lech Poznan, box-to-box midfield player, as the cliche goes. But had a bit of a sort of down spell, I think, from what I've heard, after the Europa League elimination, but a great talent and a full Poland international, as is Karbovnik, who's a left-back, left-wing-back would seem to be his position as cover for Solly March in the first place. And eventually, I suppose, we hope the full-time left-wing-back with Solly perhaps fitting in somewhere else. But he comes with an injury already, so I don't think he's going to be ready to play for a while. He had a tibia problem towards the end of for the first half of the Polish season, so he won't be ready. I think Modder could be in the squad for the game against Blackpool, probably not in the starting 11 was what Graham Potter hinted, but I think he may be there ready to play some part tomorrow.
Okay, well, they've got me. Graham's said that he wants to trim the squad down a little bit. We've got 28 in the squad at the moment. We've seen Matty Ryan go. Bernardo's now gone to...
Has he gone?
He's gone, only on loan to Red Bull Salzburg, who he used to play for. I mean, with the midfield places at a premium, we've got so many excellent midfielders at the moment. Brian, I mean, who do you think we'll be seeing? Max Sanders, for instance, will he go back out on loan, do you think?
Yeah, I think that would be an obvious contender. I still wonder about... Jahanbakhsh, what part he might play. I know there was an interview which was then played down afterwards, but I wouldn't be surprised to see, obviously the Dutch league still regard him very highly. Wouldn't be surprised potentially to see him go out. It sounds like Modder is going to come in and have his opportunity fairly quickly, like Percy Tau did, rather than we saw last season, players McAllister and Lamptey having to wait quite a while. But yeah, you think there are possibilities. By the way, Jason Malumbi seems to have, that seems to be a really good move. He seems to have made an early impact at Preston and doing exactly what we know he can do.
Mm. Good team, good footballing team, Preston. I think it's just the right sort of team for him to go to, where, you know, if he does well there, I think that'll stand him in good stead, because he's playing with, you know, Millwall have got some good players, but Preston have some real players, you know, with character who I think will bring him on. I'd be interested, Brian, what do you think about Caicedo, assuming he does come? There's this story of him going out on loan again, but only 19, but he looks too good a player to be sent out to you know, Union.
There's a lot of... yeah, there's a lot of attention on him, isn't there? And it seems that Brighton's groundwork with their previous Ecuador signing, who we probably will never see, but it might have just opened the doors and simplified what might be a complicated marketplace in a way, because they've already got that contact in place and they sort of know how it works. It's one of those we'll probably hear a bit more about him when it's all done, as you know, before signings are completed and announced, nobody really says too much, and then when they are, everybody wants to tell you everything. But again, it looks a bit more a longer term, doesn't it? You wouldn't want to put the reins of midfield in his hands just yet, but it's obviously very coveted.
I mean, with him, Brian, obviously it does seem we're very much in the box to sign in, and he does look like a very exciting prospect. But will the current travel restrictions, particularly from South America, hold that up?
I wouldn't have thought. I don't think so. I mean, we saw, it's not my expert territory, but the general manager at Independiente del Valle pointing his passport at the computer screen yesterday suggests he thinks it would be a fairly promising sign. I mean, it's obviously with, say, Jakob Mode, for example, I don't think he had to do quarantine. He just did a test and was, if it was negative, then he could train. So I don't know how it works with professional sportsmen, but in the general scheme of things, I think it's a longer term thing anyway. So it's not my expert field, I must admit.
Well, we haven't quite got that one over the line yet, so we'll watch this space and see what happens with that. So hopefully we've got a future star on our hands. Al, just before we close, you quickly wanted to talk about the Albion's donation of the laptops.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that Paul Barber, he was in an interview with TalkSport this week. There's a 25 grand donation that the Albion as one have made towards schools laptops. Now, we're not going to get political about it as to how and why this should be, but it is actually, I think, very much indicative of the club's outward look towards the community. Now, my partner, she's a school teacher. She's having to go in through lockdown, teach kids, and there's always about six or seven kids in her class. There's some that she can do online within the class, but some still need printed work on account of the fact that, you know, they don't have access to laptops. So this kind of thing, and I don't know how many 25 grand could buy. They don't have to be high spec. They're buying them in bulk. So I'd like to think it's a reasonable number for kids around Sussex. This is actually just something brilliant that I just think that the club should be commended over.
That's all we've got time for this week. So thank you so much to Brian Owen, to Nick Trepanic, to Alan Wares. I've been Amy Packham. This has been the Album Raw, associated with shirts.com, on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again. Now it doesn't make me feel I ought to be alone again. Anyone who takes offense. How?
Clear as heat.